Bandula?
Bragg?
Here.
Cole? Cunningham? Diaz?
Present.
Gomez?
Here.
Hall?
Here.
McClellan?
Here.
McWhorter? Rios?
Here.
Roberts?
Here.
Salas?
Present.
Sankey?
Here.
Zaff?
Thank you. If I can get a motion for approval of the minutes, please? Thank you, Ms. Mayor.
Second.
I'll take Lori. I heard two voices. I'll take Lori Bragg. Thank you. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Against? Motion stands. We do have several slips for public comment that are all related, so we're going to take them all, but they're going to be limited to 1 minute. So I'm going to start with Valerie Hicktower. Hicktower? Okay, so we'll skip her. Kristen? Victor?
Good morning, Chair Gomez, MTS Board, and CEO Paul Jablonski. I'm Kristen Victor, longtime resident and business owner in Pacific Beach, co-founder of Beautiful PB, the Pacific Beach Eco District. Pacific Beach has created a conscious community of residents, property owners, business owners, and visitors. We're a cross-generational eco district, one of 13 pending certification eco districts in North America, committed to 100% carbon neutrality. Our leadership is working to align community, developers, policymakers, and investors in a powerful way to move projects from vision to reality and make equity and sustainability fundamental to Pacific Beach. Our small ask today of MTS is your commitment and leadership in creating neighborhoods for all by supporting our three-year effort of a Main Street Farmers Market by putting on as an agenda item for May 2018. Thank you so much for your support.
Thank you. Next, Kathy Matchett, and then following, Hanish Pelika.
Good morning, Chair Gomez, board members, staff. My name is Katie Matchett. I am a PB resident. I'm also on the board of Beautiful PB. And my family loves to walk and to bike and sometimes even skateboard in Pacific Beach, but we want to be able to do that safely. So we know that Garnet Avenue in the heart of our community is a Vision Zero corridor. It has two of the most dangerous intersections in all of our city. Our community has been asking for years to take one small step towards changing that by closing down part of Garnet Avenue one day a week for part of the day to allow for our farmers market, but because that involves relocating some bus routes, we need your help to do it. So along with other community members here, I'm asking you to add an agenda item, an action item to your agenda for your next month's meeting so we can discuss our farmers market relocation and for your support of that. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Hanish Polakal. I'm a resident of Pacific Beach. I'm also the chairperson of the Pacific Beach Planning Group, here for the same issues that Kristen and Katie are, which is rerouting the buses on Garnet for our farmers market. On January 19th, 2017, we did meet with MTS board members to urge relocation of some of these routes so we can accommodate the farmers market. Our planning group reviewed this item in April of 2017. Our board members have voted to approve it 9-4 to relocate from Baird to Garnet on Tuesdays so we could accommodate the farmers market. Our community plan's been written back in 93, and it really stresses the focus on pedestrian and non-vehicle transit. And since then, really not much has happened in our community to accommodate that. This would be a great first step in that direction. This is what the community wants to see, and we've done a lot of traffic counts. We've gotten information from other places. This is kind of interesting to know. There's about 18,000 cars that travel down Garnet during this time, about 16,000 pedestrians, and from what we've counted, about 1 to 2 passengers per bus on the 8 buses that travel during this time. So we've got 16 bus riders versus 16,000 pedestrians that are on the street. A more prominent position for our local Tuesday farmers market will generate attention to our commercial corridor, increase foot traffic for local businesses, stimulate community interaction, all while promoting walkability.
Your time is up, sir. If you can please,
yeah, for sure.
One last sentence.
Yeah, I'm here today to request the MTS board Chair Georgette Gomez, agendize a formal action item at your next regularly scheduled meeting to discuss the farmer's market relocation. Thank you.
Dave Patel, and then following Denise Friedman.
Good morning, Chairman Gomez, MTS board members, MTS staff, and CEO Paul Jablonski. Thank you for allowing me to for time to speak to you this morning. My name is Dave Patel. I'm also a PB resident. I'm here representing JN Financial Services. We are a major property owner on the proposed Garnet Avenue block. I am here to speak on behalf of JN Financial in support, to move the PB Tuesday Farmers Market to Garnet Avenue. JN Financial believes this is a step forward in creating a safe environment on Garnet Avenue block, which has a high pedestrian and bicycle activities. And this closure will benefit all of us. Data has proven when reducing car-centric mobility on community main streets, the merchant revenues will increase in some instances as high as 40%. JN Financial supports the Pacific Beach Eco District and the Pacific Beach communities in a vibrant and thriving Garnet Avenue. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Gomez, MTS board members, MTS staff, and CEO Paul Jablonski. Thank you for allowing me time to speak to you this morning. My name is Denise Friedman, and I am today representing the Pacific Beach Town Council and the residents and visitors of Pacific Beach. In 2017, our town council members voted to support the relocation of the weekly Tuesday Farmers Market to Garnet. As you may know, Garnet has been identified as one of the 8th most dangerous corridors in the city of San Diego, and we would like to say the most dangerous in our community. We need your help and support to change that. Throughout the city, and indeed throughout the world, we can cite examples of positive impact farmers markets have had in communities, from City Heights to Little Italy, Hillcrest, Ocean Beach, to name just a few. And in Los Angeles County, both Westwood Village and Santa Monica have been acclaimed for their farmers markets. Our community has expressed its desire for a first-class farmers market, but we feel we have not yet been heard. I am here today to request that the MTS board chair agendize a formal action item at the next regularly scheduled meeting to discuss our farmers market relocation. I thank you for your time, and Pacific Beach thanks you for considering
thank
our
you.
Request.
Brian Dolap and Laura Ambrose.
Good morning. My name is Brian Dunlap. I'm here today on behalf of Discover PB and the Mad Beat, a small business on Garnet Avenue between Cass Street and Mission, where we're looking to kind of move the farmers market. I can tell you that we have support of every business on that corridor. I've gathered signatures personally, and we're looking to take PB into a kind of a place where you come to enjoy as a family. To no longer be a bar scene. So allowing us to move this farmers market from our main street to Garnet, I think would help that sufficiently. Thank you.
Good morning, board. My name is Laura Ambrose. I'm a longtime resident of Pacific Beach. We also own two businesses, actually, in Pacific Beach. One is on Garnet Avenue, and the other is our corporate headquarters. Our company is called Woodstock's Pizza, and we're throughout California. I would just like to let you know that as a longtime resident and a business owner, I do support this effort to move the buses one day a week off of Garnet Avenue for our farmers market. I think it's important to state that there are three parallel streets that are all one block apart from Garnet that already have bus routes. So we have four streets all one block apart in Pacific Beach that parallel each other, and we're asking for one of those, Garnet Avenue, to be exempted for this weekly farmers market. So I would ask that you be that you put this on your agenda for next month. I also want to state for the record that this is the last impediment to actually getting this done. So I would really urge you to consider this as quickly as possible. Thank you.
Thank you, and good morning, everyone. And again, thanks for allowing all of us to speak. My name is Sarah Burns. I'm the executive director of Discover Pacific Beach. We're the permit holder, and in partnership with SD Weekly Markets, we manage the Pacific Beach Tuesday Farmers Market. As you've heard from the community members today, this is something requested by both business and residential community for the positive impact it will have on many areas of our community goals. Specifically for the business district, most of us host these types of events to create a community connection to and increase foot traffic to our retail storefronts. However, in the current position, the farmers market is merely adjacent to sides of buildings and parking lots, which defies the purpose from the business district standpoint. At the request of our constituents, I have been working with the city and MTS staff over the last couple years on this proposal. However, we have yet to receive a proposal that would be a viable solution for both the market and the bus routes. I do believe there's a solution out there that is viable for all parties and request the opportunity to discuss this as an agenda item with all of you in more detail next month. Thank you.
Thank you. And lastly, Valerie Hiover, and you'll have 3 minutes. Hightower. Oh, yes, Hightower.
I've been on this issue for several years. The number 4 needs to be increased. If nothing else, a loop bus from here to Euclid, because kids are going to school nowadays and they're trying to work. And the service on the number 4 has never been changed. The windows on the buses that do open, can y'all get them unlocked so you can get some fresh air on the bus? These dogs that are on these buses with no windows, a lot of people have allergies. All of them are not service dogs. So can you compose a copper's card, $5 a month for these dogs? Plus, can they wear muzzles and can they be in carriers? I need bus benches on 47th and Imperial and 47th and Market. And there's a man riding the trolley that are selling tags that says service animal. He's charging $25 a pop, and I don't know if he's real or not. And the last thing, would you please inform your new drivers what dual purpose mean? Thank you. God bless.
Thank you. And for those that came to speak on the PV related issue, we're going to be connecting with staff as well as city staff just to figure out where things are at. I'm not sure if this item will be agendized next month, but thank you for coming here and for bringing the item forward. But we'll be working on that. Thank you.
Ms. Chair, may I make a comment?
Yes.
Thank you. We have been dealing with this for the last couple of years, and I personally, I support the community in their effort, but I would like to see a robust information, possible action item on all of the logistics for, you know, all of the various alternatives, either rerouting or if what the passenger loads are during that time. Maybe you don't actually need it during that time. And, you know, all of the information that has been discussed with staff and, you know, just a robust, because, you know, this community, I know you haven't been here during the, you were here last year, but not the year before. They have been coming over and over and over. And I've been asking for, as well, information on this and trying to see if we can get to a place where we can actually accommodate this. So, you know, to just try and finally help the community, I would love to have a robust information item on this particular issue and all the logistics and everything that's been looked at and all so forth.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Hall?
No, I'm fine. Just if you need a second, I agree.
Okay. What's in from it's public comment. There's no, yeah. Thank you. So moving forward to consent agenda items, are there any requests to pull items?
Yes. I'm not sure if I need to pull or just ask a question on item number 10. This is the contract with Clear Channel Outdoor. My understanding in just the last few weeks that Clear Channel is in the process of bankruptcy proceedings, and that it's their future is a little well, kind of precarious at this point. Whether they're going to be selling to somebody else, whether they're going to be shares, you know, pro rata on whoever, you know, how much what they owe or so forth. So, I just don't know if the bankruptcy has any impact on awarding, not awarding, we're receiving the money from them, just to make sure that we actually receive the money if something happens. So okay. Should I pull that? I'm sorry.
Yeah, this was a part of the discussion as we had negotiations with Clear Channel, and really it's relevant to their parent company, iHeart. We had conversations relative to this, and in iHeart's debt portfolio, there were some junior debt obligations that they had the cash to pay it, but they withheld those payments. The board directed to do that so that they could restructure that debt. So it was a decision by their board to really further the negotiation of the restructure. We looked at their balance sheet. Their balance sheet's very strong. We have a contract with them on bus shelters. They've made payments. They meet their minimum annual guarantee. We're comfortable with their financial situation, and we think that this is the right decision to move forward with them.
Okay, so I'm just reading articles
sure.
on that, and they're talking about one possibility, selling all their assets off to other companies, and so I don't know if whatever agreement, if that carries forward, and if we have a plan B, if this doesn't happen. I mean, we're receiving the money. Thankfully, we're not paying the money.
right. No, it's and Clear Channel has made all their revenue obligations to us with our other contract. And if there became a point where they decided not to make those payments, we could, terminate that contract and continue to put up the ads and take down the ads ourselves while we look for a new vendor in order to satisfy that requirement.
Okay, if they don't pay, is there some stipulation? Well, I guess when they're not paying, but stipulation, because it costs money to go and take down all their ads and,
correct.
And go through this process all over again.
Correct. Yeah, but we feel comfortable that they're going to satisfy the terms of the contract.
Okay. All right. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Alvarez?
Just to follow up on that, and I also have questions on item 6. The minimum annual guarantee, the only thing we have in terms of the contract itself is the spreadsheet on the minimum annual guarantee. That's $955,000. That's on a monthly basis payment? Is that how the contract is structured? We do not have a copy of the contract.
So the minimum annual guarantee, which I believe we will receive monthly payments on, is year one would be $955,000.
Okay.
So they take a pro rata rate of that on a monthly basis and make that payment to us. At the end of the year, they true up all the actual sales, and then we will receive that. If anything was in excess of that minimum annual guarantee, we'll receive a check on the 12th month.
Right. And I heard you, and I was glad to hear that they've been making their payments. What is our recourse if they do not make a payment at a month, if something were to go wrong? Because they will still be getting the revenue from the advertisers, but
yeah, so this is just, if something like that happened, it would be on us to act quickly. You don't want to give them too much
right.
of a leash, because if they're having problems, and so that would be just us doing good contract management. And if they don't make a payment, exercising our rights to declare them in default and give them the amount of time in the contract to cure, but then terminate
okay.
and take over.
I'm comfortable with that. I'd move the item, or at least this item. I have questions on item number 6. This is the policy on advertisement. If I recall correctly, about 4, 5, maybe 6 years ago, there was an issue with allowing advertisement from an organization, a nonprofit organization, trying to do voter registration that was not allowed because of this policy. Does that still remain in effect? Is that 21.3E? Is that what the problem or the conflict was?
Well, in general, to keep our First Amendment our commercial advertising policy a commercial advertising policy and not have us become a First Amendment forum, we don't generally allow issue ads. But what we did, and what would have allowed that vote thing, is that we do allow, and we made these revisions really after that, to specifically allow public service announcements, but they have to be either sponsored by MTS, so if MTS has like a joint thing or another public agency. So with the vote one, if somebody wanted to go and do a partnership with the San Diego Registrar of Voters Office, then we could accept an ad to say, go out and vote, you know, but we can't, if we allow just any independent agency to just do a public issue kind of advocacy ad, then that strays into becoming the First Amendment forum that, you know, our board has typically said we don't want to because we don't want to get into the middle of all of the controversial political debates. So we made amendments, the public service is also, if you want to add a, if you're going to do something about an existing public service or program, you know, that's not necessarily advocating. If the government has this program that says do this, you know, then as opposed to advocating for legislative change on some sort of program, but that's kind of
the distinction. No, I'm not interested in any of that advertisement. That in that scenario, it was just like go and vote. And
that's where, I mean, the problem with the commercial policy versus the First Amendment, there's lots of issue ads that are not controversial that everybody would want. But if you allow that ad, then you have to allow the ad of all the, you know, really controversial back and forth.
All right. I won't further discuss that maybe for another time. But as I read the specifics, that came to mind. So thank you.
Joyce. See any other requests or questions related to the consent? We do have some public comments related to the item 7, MTS Taxi Public Liability Insurance. I'm going to take public comment for that. Mr. Mikael Hassan, you have time seated, so you'll have 5 minutes. Yes, that would be you. Thank you. Time seated.
Good morning, Madam Chair, and good morning, everybody. My name is Mikael Hussein. I'm the President and CEO for United Taxi Workers of San Diego. So UTWSD is advocacy group started 2009, and we work three different MTS taxi administration managers. And I have to admit that the current administration, they're doing a great job. Mr. Nicholson, he called us an ad hoc, you know, last time and two times, and we did talk about issue about the industry and how we can enhance the industry and change. As you know, that taxi industry is invaded, unregulated TNC like Uber and Lyft, as unfair competition. Everybody knows about that. And one thing, actually, for sure, as an organization and also as a driver, as a city of San Diego, I've been very fortunate to work the last 8 years with the drivers. I've been canvassing last week and yesterday, most of my time, you know, that hot, I spent at Marriott Hotel and some of the downtown. And I was talking to the taxi industry group and asking them about their issues. There's so many issues in the industry, you know, what it has to do about the airport. It has to do with some of the hotels that, you know, and this has come to our attention. I know some group, they haven't give up, and a lot of our drivers, most of them, they give up. They return their medallion, a lot of taxis on the streets, and we have bigger issue in the industry. And I want to think about this board, especially, you know, during my advocacy, I see that things is changing, and people, they are resilient, and they want to continue to fight, and they don't want to give up. And that's where, you know, UTWSD encourage us every day to wake up and work for 16 hours for taxi drivers advocacy. As we've been saying that there's two ad hoc meeting, and they all approved that 350. We went to the city council and approved the last on March 19. 6-3 vote, and thank you for Ms. Gomez, for your leadership for that. And we want to ask this board to do two things today, if it's possible. One is to approve the recommendation 350 to 1 million. That's one has to go through today. And the second is to implement today, and I will tell you why. I was working with one of our driver actually yesterday. He was negotiating couple insurance. One of the insurance, they told him you have to pay $400. And you have to sign contract for 12 months. And you say, we have it tomorrow, it's going to be implemented. Can you give me a couple more days? They don't want to give it to him. And MTS is required that gentleman to show insurance that day, yesterday, otherwise they will strip his medallion. So the driver has to choose one or the other. To pay that $400, they are asking the insurance they take an advantage, or to give his permit. So we help him to get his insurance back, and now he's not feeling well today. He's not here. So I'm asking, and I know this is something like front of the line privilege. Some of you know about the airport last time, 2012, they implemented right away. So we are asking this board to implement right away so the insurance company, we can send the message. So today is going to be the day we change the insurance, and they have to abide by this board. And thank you very much for your time for the long time, and you will see us more about industry advocacy. We have several issues. We got to work through who is belong to these issues. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate that.
Thank you. Mr. Adrian Kiatswatsky.
Said close.
Three. Kiatswatsky.
Good morning. My name is Adrian Kwiatkowski. I'm the president and CEO of the Transportation Alliance Group, and I represent numerous legacy transportation providers at San Diego International Airport. I represent all the taxis at the airport, which is now almost about 40% of your MTS fleet. So I've got shuttles, I've got off-airport parking operators, we have charter operators. So I'm here on behalf of my taxi members, and we are in support of lowering the insurance requirement from $1 million to $350,000. San Diego is the only city in the top 10 cities in the United States by population that has $1 million. We are one of only four jurisdictions in the whole state of California that has $1 million. Cities larger than us, like Los Angeles, have less. Sacramento has less. And we're asking you to reduce the level. We're in support of the staff recommendation. The staff report is very detailed and very accurate. And when you look at taxi insurance throughout the United States, we have always been on the high end, and there's no justification for that. When you compare our insurance requirements to what the requirements are for Uber and Lyft, it's not the same playing field. We have to get commercial insurance. We have to tell the insurer how many vehicles we have. One of my members, USA Cab, for example, has to get a policy for 36 vehicles and provide a list of all 36 vehicles. And in essence, you have to have a policy that if all 36 vehicles had an accident at the same time, you would be paying out $36 million potentially. So the policy has to be able to cover that. And Uber and Lyft get one policy and they don't give any list of how many vehicles they have. And that is why it's unfair. It's just not a level playing field. And so we need to reduce this. It's a burden. There's a lot of one-person owner operators out there, and $1 million coverage is just unreasonable. And when you look at the loss data for the last 5 years, the average loss has been $8,000. Anyone who knows insurance, if we had $1 million and there was an accident, they try to get $1 million. If the insurance requirement was $20 million, they try to get $20 million. That's how the attorneys work. They try to get the maximum possible, and we haven't had incidents like that. So in summary, we are in support of this here. As was mentioned, City Council approved this. The mayor signed it. This is the next step. We'd like this implemented ASAP, and then we're going on to the airport to ask them to do the same thing. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. And lastly, Ms. Margot Tangere.
Good morning. I usually sign in with businesswomen. I was in a hurry, so I am the one of the lease driver reps on the taxi committee elected. I agree with lowering this, and let me just add a couple of extra comments. Our cabs are covered 24/7. The insurance on any single taxi cab in this region is 24/7. On a TNC, the only coverage is when the passenger gets in the car of the TNC and the machine is turned on that the passenger's in there. The minute the passenger gets out of the vehicle, it's all over. There's no insurance. Our vehicles are 24/7. We're under 1,000 right now. We're about 850-ish cabs. We've lost a bunch of them because of the slowdown, but you add up $1 million times that, and you're hitting close to $1 billion just for San Diego for taxi cabs versus individual coverage of a passenger getting in and out of a TNC. And quite honestly, we all know incidents where the passenger was getting out of the TNC, something happened, and he's not covered by the insurance. Again, as we just heard, all our vehicles have to be listed, and the TNCs do not have to be listed. They have no idea of how many they're actually running and who's driving it. We are required to have our California driver's license, a sheriff's permit. I also have a DOD permit. I can go on the military bases. And we have drug testing, which is not required for TNC. And we have a lot of expenses that basically go with it. It has slowed down, and we are asking for a little bit of relief. I heard one comment, well, why don't we charge more like the TNCs late at night or when there's a shortage of vehicles? That's our business. We don't want to gouge our customers, and we're trying to play it fair. So we're asking for this relief on the insurance. Thank you very much. Have a good morning.
Thank you, Ms. Margo. Ms. Seth?
Yeah, somebody already mentioned it. I just wanted to be clear that we did have a robust discussion at our city council and passed this at the city council. It is fair leveling the playing field, and it was, I believe, excessive considering Los Angeles even has the lower limit that we are going to. So anyway, if I can't recall if someone moved the consent agenda, I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you. Mr. Hall?
Well, I always look at it from an insurance agent point of view, but I really have a problem with this, first of all, but because every commercial vehicle in the around has to carry $1 million just to keep the requirements up. I'm sure for any commercial vehicles we have here do. I asked for some stats, which I didn't really get, but it was close enough for me. There is a major difference in coverage. I think we said the average claim was $8,000. So they've only paid, according to Ken, they paid about 99% is under the $300,000, and that's kind of normal. The one in a million that happens, we have to worry about. But to go lower, I guess is kind of, we're going to have to do it just to keep them in business. I think it's a transitioning business, though, similar to real estate or where everybody goes on an app and pulls it up. And maybe we need to look at trying to shop for a rate like that, where when they're not in the cab, they have their own personal insurance. But same problem is nobody's going to insure them. It's really hard to do that. So I think we should look at going ahead and lowering it, even though I wish to vote no on it just out of my own.
Thank you. Would that be a second to the motion, Mr. Hall? Thank you. And just for, I appreciate everybody in the comments that were related to item 7. I do want to ask staff, if it does get adopted, does it enact today or?
Yes, it would go into effect today.
Okay, thank you. So with that, I'm going to call the vote. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those against? Okay, on item 7, Mr. Hall is registering a no. Thank you. This is consent.
This is all yeses on all consent items except for number 7, where Mr. Hall is voting no.
Okay. Thank you all for a robust consent agenda item. So moving on to the finance workshop and call staff. We will have a fiscal year 2019 operating budget discussion. Turning over to staff.
Good morning. This is our first draft of the FY19 operating budget. Last month we gave you a high-level projection. This is more in the weeds now. I just want to talk real quick about our process for developing the operating budget. We do use a zero-based budgeting process for our operating budget. So in historical budgeting, you typically justify the variances from year to year, but we really go from dollar zero and build up the budget from every line item every year, every dollar. So that process begins each year in about January. Managers have a system that we use now to consolidate this information. And these submissions are pretty much due at the end of January. And then we have meetings to sort of review everything and validate the assumptions and make sure we agree on what is in there. And then those assumptions are ultimately presented to senior management and then ultimately the MTS board here. So that's just a little bit about our process, same process we've used in the past. So I'm going to talk about the major revenue assumptions. We talked about federal revenue a lot with the CIP budget last month. Nothing's really changed here. We do have legislation in place through fiscal year 2020. It's the Fixing America's Surface Transportation Act. That affects our formula funding for 5307 for urban area formula funding and then 5337 for our state of good repair formula funding, and also a small amount for 5339, which is bus facilities formula funding. All that it pretty much goes to capital, but we try to put as much as possible into the operating budget for preventive maintenance, and we talked about this at CIP last month. It helps us maximize the cash flow with these federal funds because they are received on a reimbursement basis. So by keeping them in the operating budget, we spend it first, we spend it faster, and allows us to draw those funds down. So we do swap these funds with TDA in the capital every year. So usually when there's an increase on one side or decrease on one side, it's the increase on the other side, on TDA and federal. So we are increasing the operating budget, the federal dollars in the operating budget by $2 million, and that will get swapped back into capital next year. And then you'll see our TDA dollars going down because of the way we share those dollars between capital and state. But that, again, that's primarily just for cash flow, spend other people's money first and draw that money down after we spend it. Talking next about TDA and Transnet, these are our sales tax generated revenues. The chart on the bottom of the page shows the last 10 years of sales tax revenues, and you can see coming out of the Great Recession, we bottomed out in fiscal year 10, and since then we've had steady growth for 9 years in a row. We're projected to grow again next year of growth. And you can see the very first part of that bottoming out, it was much faster rise. And over the last couple of years, the growth has slowed a little bit. These projections for sales tax are generated by SANDAG, so we just take the numbers they use and incorporate them in our budgets. We are doing very well for this year. We are on target to make our FY18 projections. We're at 3.3% growth year over year combined through Q3 of our fiscal year. So that is obviously positive news. The growth for FY19 is projected to 2% growth for TDA and 3% growth for our formula piece of Transnet. So the Transnet piece, whatever Transnet receipts are received, they go right to the operating budget. So that 3% increase is about $800,000 of additional revenue included in the FY19 operating budget. The TDA piece, as we discussed with the federal, we sort of swapped that. So even though overall TDA revenues are growing, the actual share in the operating budget is decreasing by $1.1 million as we move dollars around for the CIP. Now, this is just the formula piece of Transnet. We also receive Transnet operating funding for reimbursement of our BRT and Superloop routes. I'll talk about that later. We have an initial projection for this now, and we'll have a better projection for that next month. State transit assistance. This is our, it's a sales tax on diesel fuels. And we have a chart that goes farther back. This chart goes about 12 years back. And you can see prior to the Great Recession, we were receiving a large amount of state transit assistance. And then in the Great Recession, that money was taken by the state and included in the general fund. And we didn't receive anything in fiscal year 10. But that was reinstated after lobbying by the California Transit Association. So you see in FY12, when that money came back, we considered that at that point in time very unstable funding. You know, we lost it, we had it, it was very variable the years before that. So we have been primarily including this money in the capital budget since it's so unstable. Then FY13, we started including $3.6 million in the operating budget to pay for the Sunday service restoration. We'd cut services a lot during the Great Recession, so we were restoring services. We were using $3.6 million of STA at that point in time, because we'd had 3 years of a very stable receipts at that point in time. Again, this sales tax is tied to diesel. So if you look at the trend from FY13, it's generally a downward trend as diesel is being used less and less in the state. The actual overall pool of money goes down every year. That changed in FY18 with the implementation of Senate Bill 1. We talked about that a lot last month as well. We started receiving funds in February for Senate Bill 1, and we expect to receive funds going forward as long as the ballot measures don't take it away in November. So with the Transit Optimization Plan, we used $2 million of that new funding in the FY19 operating budget for pay for that service. Now, the $2 million that we're planning on using here is money that we're receiving this year. So all the money we're receiving this year wasn't originally programmed in the FY18 budget because it was, you know, still so new. So all that money we received this fiscal year, we're using $2 million of that for next year. So you see the blue bars for next year as we have a full year of formula, and also we have get a state of grid repair capital piece as well. None of that FY19 money is programmed anywhere. We didn't reprogram it in CIP or in the operating budget. So at this point in time, we're not planning on using that. By mid-year next year, we'll know what happened at the ballot box, and we can make decisions on how to use that money going forward if it's still around. But as of right now, we are not including any of that money in the budget at this point in time. And I think it's important to note that we will get probably $4 million from July to October of next year, no matter what happens on the ballot, because the election is not till November. So we have $4 million of fairly sure we're going to get that we have not programmed as well. So we'll talk about that again later on, but I just want to make a point of that now. Another major assumption is the passenger levels. We peaked on ridership in FY15, and then since then we've been steadily declining. We adjusted the FY18 mid-year budget down because passenger levels keep declining, and we also did the TOP program to realign our services to hopefully stop that decline and generate new ridership. So as of right now, we're not really projecting any new growth in ridership, any baseline growth. We are projecting growth for two reasons. One is for TOP, by adjusting the service and the amount of service in certain areas, we expect that to generate between 1.7 and 2.6 million riders when that system is now mature. But for this first year, with everything just going in place in January, we're just assuming 800,000 additional riders for FY19 for TOP-related service enhancements. We are also having the South Bay BRT go live in January of 2019. So we'll project additional ridership for that. It's about 600,000 riders as well for FY19. Now, South Bay BRT being a funded, it's Transnet-funded route, you'll see additional ridership here. You'll see additional expenses in the operating budget. And both of those, the net of those two will be paid for by Transnet operating funds. So you'll hear that a lot, South Bay BRT, in a lot of different places, because it is a new thing for FY19's budget. One major assumption that this is making is that we don't have any further declines in ridership. It assumes flat with FY18 and then a little bit of growth for TOP and a little bit of growth for South Bay BRT. So that assumption is something we're watching very closely, making sure we can really do bottom out on our ridership towards the end of this year to make sure we're in a good place for FY19. So that's something we're still monitoring, and we'll come with our best guess again next month. We are not proposing or planning on any fare revenue increases at this time. So these the revenue assumptions we're making is basically the same level of fares we have today. So if there is a fare increase that has passed, that would be additional revenues, I assume. But that is not reflected in any projections at this point in time. So based on about $1.4 million in ridership growth, it's about a dollar a fare on average, so it's about $1.4 million overall increase in passenger revenue built into this latest forecast. So this next slide is our first draft of this revenues for FY19. That you see passenger revenue is $1.4 million. It's an increase of 1.5%. Other operating revenues is declining slightly. We increased that budget at mid-year, if you recall, for FY18 due to the high price of energy credits. So those prices are historically high. So we brought that assumption down for next year, just assuming that it's going to come off that peak a little bit. So we reduced those assumptions for FY19. At the same time, we do have additional revenue in there for the Green Line naming rights. We had a half year of revenue in FY18 for that. We'll have a full year of revenue in FY19, so that's an increase of about $300,000. We also are assuming additional increases in interest income for next year because the rates are coming up. So we factored that in as well to offset some of the lost revenue from the energy credits. So in total, you can see operating revenue is down, other operating revenue is down by about $300,000 forecast for next year. We talked about federal. It's increasing primarily $2 million for the preventive maintenance, and then some of the smaller programs are also increasing as well. Our TDA is dropping by $1.1 million if we share it with capital. The Transnet formula we talked about. Transnet operating fund, again, this is a projection. This is the reimbursement. We have to finalize the rates that we charge for these services with Sandag and the service levels. So we'll have a better number on that next month. This is basically just a guess at this point. But it's definitely going to be an increase because we have a whole new level of service for South Bay BRT. So I put $2 million in there for this forecast of increase on that reimbursement revenue. State transit assistance, we have $5.6 million for the service increases in there. And then other revenue includes other state and local funds. We're not projecting any changes to those at this point in time, so that was flat. So in total, you can see about a $5 million increase in subsidy, about $1 million increase in operating revenues for $6.1 million total increase in revenue. That's a 2.2% increase in overall revenues with this draft of the budget. So I want to quickly touch on service levels. We are increasing service levels both because of TOT and South Bay BRT. It's about a 3.3% increase in service levels. And you can see this chart for the last 10 years of how service has been growing. But then we actually had the same level of service from FY16 to FY18, really. And then we're increasing FY19 for South Bay BRT and for TOP. We are not projecting any changes in the ADA paratransit service levels. That had been an item that had been growing very rapidly for a few years. For the last year and a half or so, it's been very stable. So we're projecting that same level of service into next year for ADA paratransit. Moving on to our expense assumptions, starting with personnel, our labor expenses are increasing by $1.5 million, to 2% increase. We're not projecting any changes to headcount. The regular wage increase is about $2 million, 2.8%. This includes a management pool merit pool for management at 2.5% increase. There's also a performance improvement program at 0.75% that is paid at the CEO's discretion. Those are the same numbers that we've had in FY18's budget for next year, same as well. The bargaining unit, all contracts are in place for this. With the exception of ATU, I believe, and those ranges, those increases are ranging from 0.5% to 3% in this next year for their base rate increases. Overtime costs, we are projecting a decrease of about $500,000. If you recall, we increased this at mid-year this year as our experience was unfavorable for the first half of the year. We expect that to normalize next year and get back down to a more regular number that we have in there. So we expect some savings, next year for overtime. And then we do have the minimum wage increase going from $11.50 to $12 on January 1 of 2019. On the fringe side of personnel, we are seeing increases about $1.4 million on that side. It's 2.7% increase. We're seeing about $1 million increase in pension plans. We use our actuarial reports and basically plug that into our budgets. So per our actuary reports, the gross plan costs are increasing by about $1 million. Half of that is in the San Diego Transit self-funded plan. That's about a $500,000 increase. And then our CalPERS plans are also increasing by about $500,000. We have a number of CalPERS plans, and they are sort of doing the same changes that we did on our San Diego Transit plan a couple years ago. They're making changes to the mortality tables. They're making changes to the discount rates. And that's just now hitting our numbers for this next year. So there we had CSR increases in our unfunded liabilities on the CalPERS side is leading to increased costs on that side as they implement those changes on their side. Healthcare costs are decreasing by about $500,000, a 3.3% decrease. We replaced our Anthem HMO PPO plans in January with a new program called NextGen, and it's a EPO PPO. And there's overall rate savings of about $1 million for this calendar year, for calendar year 18, for MTS by making this change, getting away from Anthem's rates. So about half of that savings was realized in FY18, and then we'll see another half of that savings in FY19. And then we expect it to be similar levels in the second half of FY19. And then that is being partially offset by some increases to our regular plans with Kaiser and our also our bargaining unit in contract obligations. Those are both growing in the 2.5% range. So it is partially offsetting the savings we're seeing on that big major change to get away from Anthem and move to Next Gen. Other fringe benefit costs are also increasing by about $1 million. That's our paid absences, workers' compensations, and taxes, et cetera. The next major expense that we have is with purchase transportation. Our purchase transportation costs are increasing by over $6 million next year. That is somewhat misleading, as that's all primarily service related. With South Bay BRT is being run by Transdev, so that's $4 million of additional service just related to South Bay BRT. If you just look at the contractual rate increases, our fixed route contract is with Transdev. That's the majority of our purchase transportation costs. They operate both South Bay and East County facilities and run all the service out of those divisions. The rate increase there is about $1 million. It's a 2.1% increase in the overall rate for that contract. Then First Transit has two separate contracts with us to run our Copley Park division. They run our ADA service out of there, and they also run our minibus service. There's minor cost increase on that side, a 3% for ADA, which is about a $400,000 increase, and then 2.6% on the minibus. It's about a $100,000 increase, and where there's also additional service on the minibus side as related to TOP as well. So there's about $150,000 of increased service on the minibus side. So that basically makes up the overall increase in purchase transportation, highly related to service levels. Moving on to our energy assumptions, I'll start with electricity. Electricity is our largest energy expense. This primarily is our traction power for our light rail vehicles on the trolley side, but also we have facility electric as well. There's three components on the electricity side. There's the transmission and demand that we pay for SDG&E, and then there's the commodity that we pay. We pay market rates. We buy the commodity directly from the state through the direct access program. So that is basically whatever the market is providing. So it's basically how that changes. And the third component is the actual uses. Now, we're not going to see much change in our uses this next year, and we've been very steady the last couple of years. We expect that to continue. We are expecting a large change in the SDG&E rates. We're already seeing it starting in January. They moved the demand window different times of the day, just playing with that, and it has a dramatic impact in our costs. So in 18, we projected growth. If you can see in the chart, we were about less than 15 cents for SDG&E versus 5 cents for the commodity. So SDG&E is three times what the actual electricity commodity costs. And that commodity cost increased in FY18, but the SDG piece really is increasing in FY18. We expect that to continue through FY19 as of right now. We do hope the commodity costs come down, because natural gas costs have been coming down a little bit, and there's some other piece built into there about just the availability of natural gas in the region that we hope will alleviate in the middle part of next year to make that overall cost come down. But in total, we're expecting about 300,000 increase on the rail side and about 323,000 increase overall for electricity as of right now. On the natural gas side, we are projecting an increase of almost $700,000. This is primarily due to volume. We have all that extra service for BRT and TOP. We're pretty much all run CNG buses, so those changed the CNG cost change as well. The overall rate, we're increasing only slightly. We expect the commodity cost to be very flat compared to this year, but we do have different components of this cost as well, and one of those components is SDG&E, not only for the delivering the CNG to us, but also for the facility electric that we compress the, facilities to compress the gas to get in the buses. So that piece, again, we expect to see increases next year, which is driving up the cost a little bit. But the overall commodity piece, we expect to be very stable in the next year as well. Gas, diesel, and propane, these costs are a very small portion of our budget. We don't really have many diesel buses left, just our commuter over-the-road coaches. The gasoline buses we have left, we're continuing to shift over to propane, and we do have some gasoline pool cars that we use that isn't changing. But overall, our use of this commodity dwindles every year. We expect unfavorable crude oil prices next year, but it doesn't really have that much of an impact as we're getting away from this. We have 97 propane buses now that used to be gasoline. But by the end of next year, we expect that to be 138 buses on propane versus gasoline. And we only have about 70 to go to get all of our gasoline buses out of the system. But that is a savings of about $10,000 per bus, depending on the prices and what housing costs. So as we shift, this number will continue to go down. That brings us to the latest draft of the expenses. You can see personnel is increasing by about $3 million, from $131 million to $134 million. Purchase transportation is about $6.2 million increase. Outside services is increasing very slightly, 1.4%, to about a $400,000 increase. Materials supplies with this draft are increasing by almost $800,000, 6.5% increase. Energy is very stable year over year. Big change in risk management. We had a lot of extra dollars in the FY18 budget for pending settlements and also legal costs. So we expect those levels to come back to a more historical norm as well. So we're projecting almost a $2 million savings in that line for risk management for FY19, which helps a lot. Other expenses are very flat. So in total, you can see expenses are growing by over $9 million, which is a 3.2% increase. But I want to sort of take a minute to talk about that 3.2% increase because it is somewhat misleading. We do have about $4.6 million of additional service in that number. That doesn't really give you a fair comparison to the previous year. We also have $1 million included in outside services for a sales tax ballot measure. That was put in at board's direction after the last meeting. And then you offset that with our $2 million savings in risk, which is really a one-time thing as well. If you look at our normal, like, overall organic growth of expenses, it's about $5.4 million, or under 2% in total. So we feel like we're holding a very tight line on expenses for next year at this point in time. But again, it's a $9 million, 3.2% increase overall. So when you compare revenue and expenses, revenue's growing by about $6 million. Expenses are growing by $9 million. So we do have a $3 million, $2.9 million deficit with this draft of the budget. But I also like to point out that this does include $5 million of TDA from capital in both FY18 and FY19, and that it also does include that $2 million of SB1 for TOP. So our structural deficit is really, at this point, is more $9.9 million, depending on how you define SB1, if you consider that one-time or recurring, which at this point we're considering that one-time until we have better news. So that's our deficit. So we've bridged most of our deficit with cap money from capital and also with SB1 money. So we have a $2 million need to balance FY19. Because the sales tax ballot measure is sort of one-time expenses, We're proposing using $1 million of the contingency reserves to pay for that $1 million of expenses and not use recurring revenues to pay for that. That would leave a balance of $35.3 million in contingency reserves, which based on this projection is a little bit under our 12.5% target, but it's above 12%, you know, so it's fairly in our range of where we want to be on a contingency reserve basis. For the remaining $1.9 million, when this is our latest draft, we continue to work on both the revenue side, there's some stuff we need to finalize, and the expense side, looking at where assumptions maybe are too aggressive or where things we just can't do next year, we can take those out. So we're still looking at that, both sides of that. Another option is to project additional passenger growth if it's warranted over the next month or two. Based on what we saw in February, we saw lower ridership, but revenue was actually up year over year. We'll have March's number in the next week or so for revenue, so we'll have a better idea of whether we think we have hit bottom and we can add some more organic growth to help pay for next year's budget, or if we just keep the assumption that we have now and just hope that we get that level of growth and $1.4 million increase. The other piece we do have available is SB1. We will get approximately $4 million from July to October of FY18, no matter what happens at the ballot. So that $4 million is not programmed anywhere at this point in time. That bridges this year. But we still do need a long-term strategy of how we address our overall structural deficit. That strategy right now is hoping to get a turnaround in passenger growth over the next year or two with the changes to our service. We also need to plan for a fare increase. I mean, that was $45 million potentially, depending on what options we take. I think something that needs to be done to bridge this deficit. And then also, SB1 is not repealed in November, we can start programming that on a normal basis and for factor how we want to use that most wisely. So that concludes our presentation. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. We have no public comment for this item. Are there any questions from board members? Yes, Ms. Berg.
Thank you. On the long-term strategy, the $4 to $5 million that you were looking at for a fare increase, was that using, what scenario was that using? The very lowest, most modest fare increase or somewhere in the middle?
That was the one in the middle.
Okay, thank
yeah.
you. Any other questions? Ms. Saff.
There we go. I was also going to ask about that because last year when I was on the budget subcommittee planning, we talked about looking into the fare increase and maybe having it a 5-year so that it scales up. Is that still on track, still being looked at? Because, I mean, structural deficit, $9 million, or almost $10 million, sorry. And even if you plan for that, you know, it's maybe 40 to 50% of the deficit structural, and so this is one of the most important things that you're looking at here: a structural deficit. You can't keep counting on possible money or the election or whatever. It has to have some certainty. So.
Yeah. So one of the things I think that you're talking about is adjusting the senior age from 60 to 65, and that was anyone who is in that program today is mm-hmm. grandfathered, and that age would increase 1 year over the course of the next 5 years so that it wouldn't impact anyone in the current, currently receiving that benefit. But we're looking at a whole host of options relative to the fare increase. I know just went to Transportation Committee over at Sandag, and there was a discussion there. And so we'll be coming back with some further discussion and options to provide to the board.
Are you looking at other options, for example, you know, ride share? You know, people are looking at getting from a trolley stop or, you know, a major bus stop and not transferring to one that stops 15 times before they get to their location. And I think more people would ride it if there was maybe some agreements that you could get off and then there would be a ride share or taxi stop right there that, you know, they could call it real, like you do at the airport, right?
and then go somewhere quickly. But I think more people would ride, except they, like myself with my daughter, I looked at, okay, great, she can get from San Diego State to Linda Vista pretty quick, but then, you know, it's 37 stops to get to a mile away from the house, and that just doesn't work. So anyway, just I think we have to really get creative with ride sharing. That's all.
Yeah, as you said, the fare increase is only half the problem. We're hoping to grow some out of it to take up a lot of it as well, but we haven't addressed that whole deficit with our long-term strategy at this point in time.
Thank you. Mr. Cunningham?
Thank you. $9.9 million deficit. One of the ways that we're proposing as a plan of action to reduce it by $1 million is to take $1 million out of our contingency reserves to pay, and I know we haven't drilled down on a sales tax ballot measure. It's kind of a concept. Right. But we put it in the budget, and so now you're trying to account for it. Does the assuming $1 million comes out of the contingency reserve, does that keep us within our policy in terms of the percentage of our reserves that we need to keep utilizing best practices?
Yeah, the policy is just a general target.
Yes.
In the past, we had a 10% target, and now it's 12.5%.
Yes.
So this would keep us at 12.3% based on these expense levels and currently in this draft. So it's very close to our target, and then we'll see how this year plays out. And usually at the end of the year, we come in ever so slightly favorable, and that money usually goes into the reserves. So we try to keep us at that level, and it just keeps us very close.
But it would drop below our last policy of 12.5.
It would, and we could always develop a strategy in future fiscal years to rebalance and get it back to that target.
I we're not going to discuss it now, but certainly I think there'll be a vigorous discussion about spending $1 million on the ballot initiative that takes us below our policy, even at any level. But that's for another day and another discussion. Thank you. Great, great report. It's hard to give a report like this when it's not all rosy, is it? Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
I mean, you know, practically speaking, there's a couple of alternatives to fund that one-time expense. I mean, we could use more SB1 money that we're getting,
right?
That's not programmed, and it's one time we know we're getting it. We could also take another $1 million from capital. I'm trying to direct our staff when we're talking about this is not to continually rely on capital to do this, because and I think we're fairly close to coming back to the board with a long-term capital needs outlook, you know, given the age of the SD100s, given electric buses, given a whole lot of other things, that you need to understand that long-term capital is not a reserve account that we can keep going to, because we're going to not have enough capital. So this was just an attempt to put it someplace where, you know, we're it's not going to really make a difference in terms of the reserve itself. But if there's uncomfort in doing that, we can take $1 million from the SB1 money.
Thank you, Paul. Any other questions? I see none. Do we need an action for this, or is this
no,
possible action?
Just report only if there's any specific direction from
the
board.
Next budget development committee is the 26th.
Yes.
Right. And
in that time, we hope to address in Mike's last slide there the remaining 1.9. We're really focused on that right now, and I think we're going to make good progress on that. To get that, so it might not be 9.9, it might be closer to 8 by the time we get done, but there's other things going on. I don't want to be too optimistic. There's things going on with law changes with Medi-Cal that affect our ADA service and our reimbursements that we get, and this is all happening, and when you have a 6-month budget cycle, stuff happens that impacts it. So we're trying to look at that, get that resolved before we go back to the Budget Development Committee with hopefully a final draft that we can bring to the board in May for passage for June. So it's still an ongoing process.
Thank you, Paul. So we are now going to be moving into closed session. So we'll be back. Thank you.
So I'll go ahead and report out of closed session while everyone takes their seats. In item number 24A, existing litigation and anticipated litigation, the board received a report and gave instructions to legal counsel. And in item number 24B, existing litigation, the board received a report and gave instructions to legal counsel.
Thank you. We have no public comments. Moving on to 45, fiscal year. It's an informational item. The fiscal year 2018 second quarter performance monitoring report. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. This is a good follow-up to Mike's presentation during the Budget Development Committee. This is our performance monitoring report. Each year we bring you an annual report in the fall on the previous fiscal year, and then in the middle of the year we bring you a mid-year update. So the Board Policy 42 has 20 different metrics that we evaluate all of our services on. During the mid-year, we bring you a subset of these, and I'd like to highlight some of them, a couple of them that you see in bold here of specific interest. And the first is the total passengers count. This is a big discussion during the budget, and so the results of the first 6 months of the year, this is July 2017 through December 2017, so quarters one and two of fiscal year 18. And ridership overall is down about 3.5%, down about 5% on the bus side and about 2% on the trolley. One thing I will note about this is that these are before we implemented any of the major TOP service changes. Those went into effect in January, so I'll talk a little bit more about those at the end of the presentation. But overall, we are seeing some challenges on the ridership side. I've broken it down by route category here. We do see increases on the rural, which is a very, very small portion of our ridership, and then some increases on the circulator side. We're looking a little bit deeper into the data for the increase on the circulator side. Most of our minibus routes are actually down in ridership. I had initially believed that the circulator increase was on our Route 904, which is our Coronado shuttle, but as I look more and more into the data, I think that it's more likely a result of changing routes between categories. So most routes are down for the first 6 months of the year, so this continues to be a challenge. One, in a way, bright spot is our MTS access. Ridership is also down a little bit, and that's a bright spot because of the cost of providing that service. So we've seen growth in the 10 to 12% range for the past several years. Now we're finally seeing some leveling off of that ridership. The challenges that we see on ridership are not unique to MTS. These are a nationwide trend. We're a little bit behind the curve in that most agencies started seeing ridership drop about 4 years ago. We had a record ridership year 4 years ago, and since then we've seen ridership start to slide. So we're following a nationwide trend that's been attributed to a number of things, probably a lot of things that are coming to head at the same time, including lower gas prices, easy auto financing, low-cost financing, changes in driver's licensing requirements, community demographics, of course, new alternatives like the TNCs and other things. So not unique to San Diego or even California. Most agencies throughout the nation that have seen any kind of an increase at all over the past few years have been agencies that opened large new fixed guideway projects like rail extensions. We've looked really deep into all of the data, route by route, area by area. There isn't any single pattern of ridership loss that we can identify. It seems to be throughout the region on all different types of routes. Most recently this year, we're starting to see a flattening of demand in some of our traditionally very strong areas, and these are rapid routes and routes serving the UC San Diego campus. Looking at the riders per revenue hour, these numbers or the trends actually follow the ridership fairly closely when we don't have service changes. So this is going to look different. You're going to start to see some changes with the second 6 months, so the second half of FY18. But since we didn't have our major service changes until January, then the service levels remained fairly similar for the first 6 months. So these trends follow the overall ridership trends. Another thing that we like to highlight periodically for you is the on-time performance. We have a goal of 85% or 90% depending on the route category. Our routes that operate in heavy urban areas have an 85% goal, and then the other routes have a 90% goal. We have a little bit of a mixed bag. Most of our categories fell a little bit underneath their goal. The rail, both the Silver Line as well as the three main lines, were all above their goal. We are seeing some challenges on the bus side. While we are evaluating all of our routes and doing a lot of rescheduling, including as part of the TOP process, we're rescheduling a very large number of routes that will help these numbers, but we're also seeing results from construction detours. There's a lot of water and sewer pipe construction, a lot of other things that our cities are doing or private projects are doing, as well as special events that are really impacting us and our on-time performance. So we continue to work on those and to work with our cities to minimize the disruption. And increase traffic, yeah, and that's actually a really good point, because that sort of hits us two ways. It hits us, one, the increase in VMTs is people that were riding the bus that are now driving or riding our system that are now driving, and then the increased traffic slows our system down. So in a way, it's a cycle that keeps going. To talk a little bit about the TOP, the whole goal of the TOP was to use some resources from underperforming routes and segments and add those to routes that do really well for us, and where we have a not only routes but also areas where we felt we didn't have enough service to meet the demand. So we began the major service changes in January, and we changed overall changed about 60 routes, but 38 of them were associated with the TOP. A lot of others were just scheduling updates, as I mentioned. We did some major revisions in the El Cajon area, and we restored a lot of the Chula Vista Sunday service. We streamlined a number of routes. We split some of our very long routes to achieve some reliability and cost savings. And then we discontinued some services that were underperforming. We're going to continue with that in June of 2018. We have about 14 more routes that we're going to be looking at. We're going to be revising the service in National City and making some major changes in La Mesa, as well as streamlining some more routes and splitting a couple of more routes as well. A few items to follow up in September as we get into the winter season and move some of our services out of the beach areas. We'll do a couple more routes in September. And then we have a few remaining routes that are waiting on other things to happen. These are 2019 and potentially beyond. For example, some routes that will change with the South Bay Rapid when that is fully implemented in January 2019, and some routes that require some bus stop and other capital improvements to be done. So the results that we see so far from the TOP, and I'll emphasize that this is preliminary data from March that I ran. I purposely didn't include February in here because it was sort of a transition month. We just put the service in the end of January. So just looking at March, at our average weekday ridership, and I pulled this because March 2017 actually had one additional weekday, so that impacts the ridership. So to try and get a real apples-to-apples comparison, I just looked at the number, average number of weekday riders. Overall, ridership was pretty flat in February. It dipped again in March. We're down about 6.3% on the bus side, and I'm just looking at bus. This is not trolley ridership. On the bus side, we're down about 6.3%. But on the TOP routes, these are the routes that you see listed below. These are routes where we added frequency during the weekday. We're actually up almost 6% on those routes. So it's about a 12% delta between all routes and the TOP routes. And when you take out the TOP added routes, then we're down about 8%. So between these changes we did in January, once those mature and we get more ridership in that increased service, as well as the changes that we're going to make in June, we hope that this is going to be the start of clawing our way back. So I think there's some real positive news here. It's a small start, but I think it's in the end it's going to be it's going to validate what we've done in the TOP. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Dennis. Great presentation. Any questions from committee members? David?
Just briefly, on the TOP routes, yes, from the last slide, what were our expected increases or increase versus where we're at? Either, well, by route would be too many, but I guess cumulatively, where would we have liked to have been according to the TOP that was approved?
So the TOP anticipated overall a total of about 1.6 million additional riders a year. These routes that you see, the change that we saw in March, if you annualize these, it's about 200,000. So it's a small number, but I want to emphasize that this is just the second month of implementation. So we always assume that we're going to need anywhere between 6, 12, and even sometimes 18 months for a route to fully mature. So I think this is a good sign. It doesn't show that what we did in January is going to completely make up that anticipated number, but it's a start. And as these mature, as well as the June changes, I think that we'll see these numbers come up.
And then the other quick question, the September change, there's three routes being impacted, but it had like none of them were splits, none of them were
right
frequency. What are the three changes there?
So the three routes are three beach area routes. It's Route 8 out to Mission Beach, Route 9 to Pacific Beach, and then Route 901 to Coronado and Imperial Beach. And these are routes that we traditionally have added service in during the summer. So the TOP is taking some resource out of the weekday service on those routes, and we didn't want to do that in the summer, so that's why we're waiting until September.
Oh,
we wanted to maintain that service out during the summer.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, there's no action needed. This is informational. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So moving on to the report and update on the Desert Line status.
Hi, good morning. We haven't had an update on the Desert Line in a while. Some things have actually been moving forward and progressing, and I am heading with the chamber to Mexico City this weekend, partly to, you know, brief with some of the Mexican officials on this project, so I thought it was a good time to give you all an update. For those of you that don't recall, the Desert Line is a railroad line that is owned by MTS, and it runs through what I call the rugged terrain of East County. It starts at the U.S.-Mexico border near Campo and extends about 70 miles into Placer City in Imperial County. And it's got over 57 bridges and 17 tunnels along the way. We have leased this right-of-way to Baja California Railroad. They are the same railroad that has the operating rights in Mexico, so right now it's a unified line across the border. They currently interchange at San Ysidro, so it's that same railroad at both ends of the U.S. border. The repair rehabilitation costs have been estimated anywhere from $60 to $100 million. Baja Rail is still working out what their reconstruction plan is and actual costs will be. Those costs will be funded by Baja Rail, and it'll include the construction of customs inspection facilities that are required to allow the transfer of freight across an international border. And that is what we've been working on now. When we did revise and do the lease with Baja Rail, recognizing that if they can't run freight across the border, then their project may not be feasible, we've deferred their construction milestones until after there's approval to build a customs inspection facility by the U.S. and Mexico government. So that's what we've been focusing on. Just to orient everyone again to kind of the intent of this project, the dark green line there is the desert line. The light green is the Mexico line that they own. And the intent of this project would be to make this new eastward connection to the San Diego Freight Railroad corridor. And it would connect up to the Union Pacific National Network. Right now there's a kind of smaller leg that runs down to El Centro, but then it connects up with the UP's main national network heading east through New Mexico, Arizona, and into Texas, where a lot of the products are. Just to orient you on the time, you know, we've got the San Ysidro border crossing the Otay, Tecate, and that star is the location of the Desert Line Railroad crossing. So the main issue that we have been working on is to find a location and design of customs inspection facilities. We've been working very closely with Customs and Border Protection on this process because it'll be a facility that is built for them to operate. Baja Rail will be in charge of paying and constructing it, and then they will turn it over to CBP to operate. So this is a unique area. It's a little inaccessible, so we've been identifying what inspection infrastructure needs to be and where. Right now we're focused on the primary inspection at the border tunnel and secondary inspection at the Campo Yard. Again, we're working closely with CBP. We did a all-hands site visit out at the Desert Line in January where we had some DC facilities folk come out from CBP, and then we had great attendance by the San Diego Office of Field Operations, the local Border Patrol stations that patrol these areas, and then the Tecate Port of Entry staff that would run the facility, and then their counterparts with SAT in Mexico. Following that, we just came back from, I did a site visit with Baja Rail and a contingent from San Diego CBP and Border Patrol, and then more, their facilities folks from DC and an architect came out, as well as a DC representative of the State Department, and we visited some Texas rail cargo facilities that are only rail in Laredo and in Eagle Pass so that we could see how their primary inspection facilities work and how their secondary work and how that could be designed to work on the Desert Line. And then we're planning an additional site visit team meeting in late May, early June with that whole group, and they're going to bring some additional experts out from CBP's DC office. So just to give you all a little sense of what we're working with, these are pictures of the border tunnel on the U.S. side. So that tunnel way at the far end of it is the U.S.-Mexico border. And then this opening is all the space that's available right as you enter the U.S. and out of the tunnel. There's that bridge, which is about 370 feet long. I haven't measured how tall it is, but I would say it's at least, you know, probably 30, 40 feet, maybe more. I don't have a good sense of space when I'm out there. I'm too scared standing on the bridge. This is the Mexico side of the border tunnel. There's a little bit more space. They will be building Mexican customs facilities on this side of the tunnel and U.S. customs facilities on the U.S. side of the tunnel. And just, you know, one of the issues that we're working with is that the border tunnel is down there on the right. I've kind of pointed out where the rail line is that you can see. And then the Campo Yard is about 5 to 6 miles northeast of that. We were worried that that was a little bit too far between, but if we do primary inspection at the border, then that is not at all unique. In Laredo and in Eagle Pass, Texas, they have primary inspection at these rail bridges at the border, but then their secondary inspection is 13 miles away. So that was actually, I think, comforting to everyone and for the San Diego officers that were concerned about this distance. That's just, right now, the Campo Yard is mostly dirt. You know, there will be full facilities will have to be built and constructed, and we would be designing around the museum so that the museum could still stay there. And then just these are some of the parameters that we're working out with the CBP. You know, that border tunnel opening footprint is very limited. It's about 30 to 40 feet across and 100 feet long. So we're trying to decide where we can place the X-ray equipment that needs to scan every rail car as it comes through that then the CBP can view at this primary location. And so we're going to try to have to fit it within that footprint and then along that bridge. And then there's about 1,400 feet, linear feet of railroad track that's about 40 feet wide that's just across the track. So we're also conscious of environmental sensitivity in this area. So we're trying to work to see how much can fit within the already disturbed flat dirt that's right there next to the tracks and not have to encroach on any of the hillsides. So that's just one of the issues that will be addressed as we work through this process. And then the other issue that we are working through with CBP is making sure that they have sufficient access to the crossing location because they'll have, you know, their inspectors that have to report to work each day. They'll have Border Patrol that will be providing security. If there's an incident, they have concerns of how do they get there. And so just the red line is the railroad line. That green line is Highway 94. And all those other little squiggly lines that you see are dirt roads up and over hills across private property that CBP uses right now to patrol that area. So that's one of those things if we want a reliable 24/7 route that people can get to that crossing, you know, authorized individuals can get to the crossing. So that's just something that we're starting to look at and see what needs to be done, what are the solutions. So, and again, you know, we need to review what type of real property easement rights does CBP have over those roads? Do we potentially need to secure more? Is there a preferred route that maybe we add a little bit of extra aggregate or paving to make sure that it stays in good condition all year round? You know, those are things that we'll work out with CBP. And then the final is, you know, this is a new crossing. CBP has very limited staffing resources. I think it's that 2,000 officers or more that they're trying to recruit. And so they don't necessarily have the staffing to just assign there. So they're gonna have to take people from other locations and assign them there. That's something that you need to have in the pipeline for quite a long time. So we're just working with them to identify what the levels of staffing resources you're gonna need at these primary and secondary locations. And how do we make sure if they give us permission to build this facility that they actually are able to staff it and open it. So that's just another issue that we'll be working through with them. So just give you an update on where we've been doing all sorts of work with local CBP, SAT. We've been very pleasantly surprised at how cooperative and proactive all of those groups have been. You know, they haven't been sitting back and saying, yeah, you know, we'll consider something if you send it to us. They're actively helping us refine the proposal so that if it's submitted, it's something that they would be willing to approve. We've been working also with the State Department and the U.S. Consulate in Tijuana. The Ambassador Marcela Solorio from the San Diego Consulate for Mexico has been very helpful for us in coordinating any of the briefings that we needed to give to Mexican officials. The International Borders and Waters Commission had to touch this. They had to go out and do a formal survey of where the actual U.S.-Mexico border is. So they did that. They completed that last year. And then again, we attended the San Diego Chamber of Commerce trip to DC in September. That's where we made some initial briefings of the high-level CBP officials in DC. And then we are scheduled to be in Mexico City this next week, where we'll be having a private briefing with the Mauricio Ibarra, who's kind of the head for Mexico SRE on some of these issues. And he is in charge for Mexico of the Binational Borders and Bridges Crossing Group, which is a binational government group that gets all the necessary agencies together to discuss border issues. And so they've asked us to also come back to Mexico City for the next meeting of that binational group in June, and then we do the regional group in fall. So that's where we are. Nothing like this ever moves quickly, but you know, progress is being made, and so you know, we're happy with that.
Thank you for the update and the progress that it has been
occurring. I see Mr. Alvarez.
Thank you. Thanks, Karen, for the update. Really appreciate it. Your last statement is so true. Even the modernization project at San Ysidro, which everybody now knows about, I started being involved with that project in 2005, and others were working on that before then. And now we're seeing the construction, but it won't be another 3 years until that whole project gets done. And so this does take time. Two quick questions on the payments issue. Have those continued to occur on time?
Yes.
Okay. And then has there been any talks about joint inspection facilities that have been, those have been authorized now by both federal governments where their officers, our officers are in one location so we don't have to build two separate locations? Have there been any discussions about that?
There have been. We originally had gone to CBP to propose a joint inspection facility on the Mexico side of the tunnel where both CBP and SAT would operate from that location. But because of the remote location of that, CBP basically said that was a non-starter for their officers to be stationed in that remote location in Mexico, that if something happened, they wouldn't be able to go get them, you know, and pull them out.
Right.
So we now have shifted to how can we be as efficient and economical as possible in those. And so we're looking at sharing data. So likely there will be some SAT officers that are stationed at the primary location in the U.S. and potentially an Campo, but they would still have their own facility in Mexico, and that's probably just a feasibility. If you do unified cargo processing where you do it all in the same location, you have to have a X-ray scanner on each side so that northbound and southbound traffic gets scanned, and then you all do the it together. And what were those scanners, the ones that they showed us that they're telling us they want that are in Texas, they said it was $14 million. So, you know, the benefits of doing unified cargo processing and then having to spend $28 million just on these two things probably will take away any of this that savings. But they are both willing to share those data feeds.
Okay.
So that's what we're working with, is that we would share the data feeds from the U.S. X-ray machine with Mexico. So, and then the things that they need to inspect in the U.S. they would do.
That would be great. It's one of the roadblocks you've had over many years about data sharing between the two governments, and so that would be really fantastic. So
yeah.
I'll be there as well next week, and so anything that you need support on, be happy to help.
Yeah, I'll coordinate my schedule if you want to come to the meeting with the
Will do. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? I see none. This is just an informational item, so no need for an action. Thank you so much, Karen. Mm-hmm. Moving on to the Douglas bike update.
Good morning. This one will be really quick. It's just to let you know that, as you all know already, dockless bikes and scooters are in the market in the San Diego County area. We have had some impacts on MTS property and our operations. It's a kind of a learning curve for everyone. A number of bike companies already are supported here in the MTS jurisdiction, Lime Bike, Bird, Mobike, et cetera. We've met with most of them. Just so that we could kind of familiarize ourselves with their operations and really to open a line of communications. We really do look at them as an opportunity for potential first mile, last mile alternatives for our own customers. So we don't want to just simply go in and say, you must do X, Y, and Z, and if you don't comply, we're going to use the powers we have to make you comply. We're not interested in bringing that approach to this. So we have educated the companies on best practices for operating near MTS services. For instance, avoid our fare paid zones. Try to make sure that you're not flooding our stations with too many of the bikes or the scooters. You know, just talk to your customers and make sure they understand how to operate within the, you know, the envelope of our transit services. We have looked as well at our various larger transit centers to see if there's a possibility of making corrals where they would be designated areas and they would put them in. We haven't really pulled the trigger on that because it involves a lot of signage and then another educational opportunity and et cetera. So we kind of are letting it play out and communicating with the various operators. We do know that we have certain corrective actions that we can take under our current ordinances if necessary. But again, we do recognize that this is a potential amenity for our customers. Here's an example of the type of thing that we've been able to change. Like this on the left is from the yellow bike company OFO. They have on their app that where to park beside bus stops. Well, we don't like that because what they're doing is they're parking them right where the ramp will come down for people that need ADA access to the buses. And it just is really a problem if they put them in shelters and things like that. So on the right is what's on there today, and it says, please avoid parking in pedestrian right-of-way, by ramps, immediately next to fire hydrants and bus stops. So that's just an example of what it is that we're able to do because we have opened those channels of communication. I could go through all these photos at length. You have them in your packet. It's just really the types of things we're seeing. A lot of it involves, you know, user error, but some of it was just their own personnel, the people who were moving bikes. They didn't understand exactly how we operate, but the customer or the management is starting to get that across to the people who are moving bikes. With that, I'll take any questions.
Thank you. Any questions, Ms. Staff?
Kind of comment versus question. I know we have different properties, but representing the beach and bay communities, we're just completely inundated in my district with bikes. And I've been stopping and taking photos and sending them in to the mayor's office. And the one just yesterday had a whole line of about six scooters completely blocking Garnett. Like they were in a line, but they were on the sidewalk. Blocking the sidewalk on Garnett, not Garnett Avenue. And so, you know, I've actually been taking photos. I'll get out of the car. I'll move them off because the city's got liability. And if somebody has an accident, I mean, they're going to come after, I think, the deep pockets on this. And so I would just kind of, I think we need to work together and have strong, you know, like you can't just leave it and block and, you know, cause hazards. There was a lady who actually, one of these caused her to fall. She didn't realize till she went home that she actually had fractures in her arm or wrist. So I'm thinking on the app, when the app says, you know, make sure you're to park safely and legally, that there should be something before they can even log out that they have to punch in that they have parked out of a right-of-way or something like that. Because what do they know what is legal? They have no idea whether it's, or do they care whether it's safe? I've seen them in the most random, bizarre places ever, like alongside the freeway on the fast lane. Think, like, how did that possibly get there? But anyway, so we're having a really big problem. Coronado, to my understanding, started impounding them. It's like, you know, you illegally park a car, your car's impounded, a tow truck comes. So I think we need to like start doing something because we're all legally, every single one of our cities will get, if somebody is in accident, they'll come after us for liability is what I think. So I think we need to really take this seriously, even though, yes, of course, it is a benefit, but it also is a huge liability as well. So thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments? Mr. Diaz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the good news is that there's so much technology wrapped around these bike shares that I think there's an answer. I'm just thinking out loud, just thinking about it right now. But Member Zapp over there talked about the app, and so I'm just thinking out, as and I'm not sure this is getting ready to talk about permitting these kind of operators in our city, but you know you could actually. Because it's all GPS operated, I mean, you could theoretically assess a user, I would suspect, through our permitting process when we permit them. If they don't park it correctly, they could get, you know, dinged a little bit for our city, for example, to go and clean that mess up rather than the operator or the owner. So maybe as we move down the line and we got all the different cities here, maybe that's a discussion that we could all be thinking about using technology to make sure that that we enforce where they park those bikes, not close to you know, maybe in the corrals or something. I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud. But the good news is there's a lot of technology where we can, you know, figure out where those, who's doing it, and penalize those folks that are being bad actors.
Well, and if your cities want some, I read through the Seattle ordinances and regulations on this, and they actually are a little in advance of us. They've had them for over a year, year and a half, or something like that. They've had an actual policy in place. You could look at that as a model if you were looking for something for your city.
Thank you. Ms. Beck.
Thank you. Ms. Cooney, I wanted to thank you for meeting with Lime Bike in Imperial Beach. And Imperial Beach has embraced it. We were one of the first communities in the region to have the Lime Bikes. We are enjoying great success. But I wanted to, and to speak to Councilmember Zapp, I think it's incumbent on each one of us that when we have these operators in front of us at our council meetings, as I did as chairman of our accessibilities committee, I really gave them a very strong warning about what can happen if they're allowing these bikes to impede access for people with disabilities, not only at the bus stations in Imperial Beach, but at the platforms of throughout the entire system. So if I could ask on behalf of our disabled riders that each one of you make those comments when you have the opportunity to speak with those riders. And Sharon, if you would forward the policies that Seattle has enacted, if you could maybe forward that to each one of us. Thank you.
Thank you for that.
It's Roberts.
Yeah, I guess I have mixed feelings about this whole thing. I think that the programs basically are beneficial. We see people using them. The problem is when there are no rules, stupidity rules. Talking to the operators doesn't get to the people that are causing the problems, who are the renters. When you see these things on the freeway, and I have, or you see them in islands on major roads where they don't belong, it's only a matter of time before you find them on the tracks and other places. Your concerns are well made, Lori, in terms of the stations or platforms themselves. We don't want these things blocking, nor do we want anything else blocking. I mean, we try to keep those so they're working, but in a situation where there are no rules, expect to have problems. And I think it's a matter of time before we have a trolley, one on the trolley tracks, and whatever happens from that, because they're being left all over indiscriminately. There's got to be, I hope that each city would kind of start to think about how you do this, because something needs to be done.
Yeah, one of the things that, and we've been watching this every day since it came out, it's kind of an artificial scenario for the first month or so because they were all free. Okay, so everybody was riding them, especially down here on Imperial. I mean, they were up and down the road with all of our neighborhood people. I think it where they were left, it upset us a lot. But ever since they started charging, which was in the last few days, and some of them, we've seen a lot less activity on them, a lot more parked. So I think in a month from now or 2 months from now, we're going to see this thing settle down, and we may have half the companies that we're going to have to deal with, and then we're going to, really have to get with those and define it and set a lot more rules. But so
I'm not sure that your prediction's accurate. The two biggest companies are not, they're Chinese companies. They're having major contest between them, and there's no likelihood that they're not going to continue the competition with Uber getting in now by buying another company. This thing's not going to get better through attrition, I can tell you.
Well, thank you all for comments and for the report and for monitoring this, and for sure as things mature, we'll definitely start talking about what are some of the barriers, what we're going to be some of the rules that we should impose. So.
And we're working on those.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much. Appreciate that, Sharon. So moving on to Sherry's report, I do not have anything to report on. Chief Executive?
Nothing.
No report as well. Any board members?
Say something really quickly.
Yes.
So I just like to report out really quickly on the APTA conference. It was the first time that I attended the APTA conference, and it was in March 17th to 20th. The theme was where public transportation goes, community grows, which I thought was really a great theme. But it gave me an opportunity to get more education on the important federal legislation and policy initiatives. And it was of great value to me to be able to advocate to our Congress folks. I do want to let the group know that had attended the meeting with Congressman Peters, which I was not able to attend, that he found great value in the conversation you had and told us to keep him abreast. So I just wanted to share that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rios, and thank you for attending the conference with staff. We do have public comment, additional public comment. Ms. Marco.
I signed in on Pacific Beach, but Lori, two things. First of all, the bicycles. I got conned into a Bell radio call over at Newton and 16th, and on Easter morning at 4:30, and the guy, two tall guys, one was picking up the bike and throwing it against an SUV. Now, by the time we finished up, the three guys from the Alpha Project came marching like this, and so I told my dispatcher I'm getting out of here because I don't want him throwing it at the bike, but Manny caught up with me, and I talked to security immediately, and also the Alpha Project. So this is another thing. They can use those and cause some damage, physical damage. Same issue on Pacific Beach with the farmers market. The city has not worked with farmers market to move it to a more viable space, but going on to Garnett on a Tuesday during the summer, we all know how heavy that street is. I mean, we're all local folks, and you need the transportation. In fact, people use the transportation to get to a farmer's market. What they did in Little Italy was they were up further on Date Street, and it blocked a bunch of, you couldn't get to the hotel, and it was blocking a lot of things that were necessary, so they moved it. So maybe the city can sit down and find a more viable place closer to Garnett that won't block the buses and won't block the emergency vehicles. This is the problem. You have to get your emergency stuff through, and good luck on Garnett when it gets really messy over there. And it's summertime, so there's more traffic. You divert some down to Grand, but you still have that blockade on Garnett. So maybe we could work out something to improve the farmers market, because it's very popular, and work both sides to make some kind of peace agreement. Thank you very much. Have a great week.
Thank you. So that concludes our meeting for today. Our next meeting is scheduled for May 10th, 2018. Thank you.